question. It's called Bris Yehuda. And the Bris Yehuda really goes through all of the modern day scenarios and all of the different configurations of Ribbis and all of its many manifestations and applications. Because it was the first work that came out, so often the first work has certain psakim and certain approaches that might be criticized or disagreed with by later authorities. So there were lots of svarim that came after the Bris Yehuda and didn't necessarily agree with everything that was said by the Bris Yehuda, but by and large, the Bris Yehuda really established the framework for the contemporary discussions in Ribbis. Subsequently, there's a very good sefer called Torah Ribbis. There's a sefer called Tam Ribbis. There was an English work that was written by Rabbi Yisrael Reisman, which deals with the laws of Ribbis. That's also a very good, very comprehensive work. There's a recent sefer Nesivos Shalom that is also kind of an updated version of many of the nuances of Hilchos Ribbis. There's one siman in particular in Hilchos Ribbis. Hilchos Ribbis appears in Yoredeya. Yoredeya deals with issues of Issa Veheter, so it's appropriate, even though Ribbis is really something that is in the monetary realm, in that it deals with loan transactions between individuals. Nonetheless, the concept of Ribbis is not just the one of a monetary law, but of a monetary prohibition. It's prohibited to collect Ribbis. Normally, if I have a Tanai Shebe Mamon, I have two people who agree that they're going to arrange their finances in a different fashion than the normal scheme of monetary law according to halakha. So we have a principle called Tanai Shebe Mamon Kayim. You can make Tanai. But in this case, when it comes to Ribbis, it's not in the realm of Mammon, per se. It's in the realm of Isser. It's in the realm of Isser Veheter. So even if I have a Malvin and a Lovin, a lender and a borrower both agree amongst themselves that they're going to violate Ribbis, that condition is null and void, because you can't make a Tanai B'mbatova Shebe Isser. When it comes to Isser Veheter, you can't make a condition around it. So all of the laws of Ribbis appear not in Chosh and Mishpat, but rather they appear in Yoredeya, because they're in the realm of Issa Beheter. The Simanim of Ribbis begin around Kuf Nuntes in Yoredeya, continue until I think around Kufayin Ches or so. And one of the most thorny Simanim is a combination siman. It's called Kuf Samach Ches and Kuf Samach Tes. It's both together, two simanim together. There are a lot of sifim, and every single one of the sifim is a very complicated scenario of Ribbis that really requires a lot of mind application to be able to figure out these brain teasers that are in the various sifim. And this Talmidim in our Yadin Yadin Kol, and they learn Hilchos Ribbis, so this is, I think it's safe to say, this is the most difficult siman. So there's an excellent sefer that just came out a little while ago called the Chilkas Binyamin. It's written by Rabbi Binyamin Cohn. He's the son of Feivel Cohn. Feivel Cohn is the famous author of Badei HaShulchan and Hilchos Nida and other sefarim. So the Chilkas Binyamin takes you through every single one of these scenarios and explains with tremendous clarity and precision exactly what every single case is talking about. And if there's a disagreement about what case is being talked about, he explains all the different possible interpretations of each case. So if you want to go through a Hilchos Ribbis Keseder in the Shulchan Aruch, then I would highly recommend, particularly for those simanim, the Sefer Chilkas Binyamin. So what is the Issa Ribbis all about? So the Torah tells us if you loan money, it's a mitzvah to loan money. That's a mitzvah tzedaka. In kesef tavis ami yaseni machlos yelo kenoshev lo sisimun alav neshech. If you're going to lend money, this is one of the cases where im kesef tavis ami, it's not just an im, it's a when. You're supposed to loan money. You're supposed to do it. But when you loan money, lo sisimun alav neshech. You're not supposed to charge neshech. You're not supposed to charge ribbis. It's called neshech because you're biting the person. How are you biting the person? You lend money and you collect more than what you loaned, so then you're biting the person. You're taking away something more than what you gave him. So when you loan money, you loan $100, so you're only supposed to collect $100. You're not allowed to collect $101. You're not allowed to collect more than what you loaned. That's considered to be the Issa Ribbis. And that's a deraisa. It doesn't matter that you feel that you want to be paid for your loss of money, that you didn't get to use the money during that time. So that's what the issur is all about. You can't charge for the use of your money, even though time has passed and you did not, you were not able to use your money during that time. You're not allowed to charge a premium. The Gemara puts it succinctly in the Gemara Baba Metzia Daf Samach Gimel Amud Beis. Amar Rav Nachman Klala De Rebisa Kol Aga Nato Le'Yosur. That the basic klal, the basic principle of how Ribis works is that any kind of schar, any kind of a payment that you're going to receive for the fact that you had to wait for your money, that's called agar nutter. You're getting a schar, you're getting agar for nutter, for waiting. So that is also, that's what's included in ribis. That's what ribis means, that you can't get paid extra because of the fact that you have to wait for your money. You only get back exactly how much you loaned. So there are two different terms that are used in the Torah with respect to the issur of ribis. One is neshech and one is marbis or tarbis. In other words, there are two elements to ribis. There's the biting of the lover that you're taking away from the lover more than what you gave him, and there's the marbis, the tarbis of the malveh, that the malveh is the lender is getting more than what he loaned. He's getting a gain. He's getting a tarbis. So the Gemara uses these terms of Neshech and Tarbis in order to differentiate. Actually, the Mishnah in Baba Metzia Daf Samach Amud Beis uses these terms to differentiate between Ribis De'Oraisa and Ribis De'Rabbanan. Uses the word Neshech in connection with Ribis De'Oraisa and uses the word Tarbis of Hamarbe Beperos, that it's in connection with transactions that maybe aren't strictly with money. There's the commodities that are getting replaced, and you're getting the premium of the improvement of value of the commodity over time. So that is that's used to refer to ribis de rabbanon. So there's a very interesting comment by the Torah Tamima. The Torah Tamima in Vayikra Perech Chofei Ha'ora Kufzadi Tes says that the Neshech and Tarbis actually do have some special meaning beyond that which is utilized for the Mishnah purposes of distinguishing between the Deraisa level of Ribis and the Rabbanan level of Ribis. That really, even on a Deraisa level, if I have a real genuine loan, then it will always include elements of Neshech and of Tarbis. The Gemara in Baba Metzia Daf Samach Tes Samad Bey says on the pasuk of Es Kaspecha Lo Sitein Lo, Lo Sitein Lo Melamich Lo Asra Torah Lo Ribis Haba Milove Milamalve. Very important principle that the Torah only prohibits ribis interest which is paid directly from the borrower to the lender. So this is extremely important because it codifies a number of different elements. It has to be a loan to be prohibited by the Torah. As I mentioned, if it's just a sale transaction where the purchaser is paying more because there's more time to pay it out, so that wasn't in the context of a loan, that's considered to be rabbanan. It's tarbis. The malva is getting, the seller is getting more money, but it wasn't a loan transaction, so that's only midrabbanan. But it also has to be ribis which comes from the lova. It has to come from the borrower and has to go to the malva. It has to go to the lender. There's a Chuvas Rashi that cited, a very controversial Chuvas Rashi, of course, cited in Shulchan Aruch, that says, well, maybe if you have a shliach who kind of transmits the money back and forth, the malva gives the money to the shliach, and the shliach gives it to the lova, and the lova gives it to the shliach, and the shliach gives it back to the malva when it's time to repay. So if that's all done by ribis, so maybe that's not included in the prohibition because it's not directly from the lova to the malva. So that's generally not assumed to be halakha l'maiseh. And the Torah Tamima says that what then really is the halakha l'maisa manifestation of the fact that it has to come from the lova to the malva? So he says it means you need a combination of the fact that the lova is losing and the malva is gaining. So the Gemara has two exceptions to the laws of ribis, of where ribis would not be applicable. The Gemara says that if I give some money to a malva, I'm a third party, and I give money to Reuven and say to Reuven, take this money, and I want you to loan $10 to Shimon. So now Shimon is going to pay back the $10. There won't be any ribbis in that transaction to Reuven, but Reuven got some extra money for the loan because I gave him extra money to make the loan. So that's perfectly permissible, says the Gemara. Or alternatively, if I'm the borrower. I'm the prospective borrower, and I say to Shimon, I want you to take money. Here's some money I'm giving you, and I want you to tell Reuven to loan me $10. Then Reuven loans me $10, and I give him back $10. So that case is also not considered to be ribbis. So why is it that neither of these cases are ribbis? So he explains, because this is the application of the principle that ribbis has to come from the lovit to the malvit. That means that in a normal loan transaction, you have elements of, in a normal ribbis transaction, you have elements of neshech and tarbis. So in the case where I am paying somebody to make a loan to somebody else, so the person who's the lender is getting a windfall. He's getting his money back, plus he's getting the amount that I paid him. So he's getting tarbis. He's getting extra. But the lover isn't paying anything extra. He didn't hire me to give over the money or anything like that. The lover is not getting any. It's not giving up anything extra, so there's no neshech. Or alternatively, when I'm the lover and I'm giving somebody money in order to convince somebody else to loan me money, so I'm giving back the amount of the loan to the person who loaned it to me, plus I'm out the amount of money that I gave to my broker, the one that I wanted to persuade the lender to loan me an interest-free loan. So that's neshech on my part, that I've given up more than the $10. I've given up $11, but there's no tarvis on the part of the malveh, because the malveh only got back his $10. It was a third party who got the extra amount that I gave them. If any of this is commanded by the various parties, that the malveh is commanding that the loveh give money to a third party, so then the malveh is getting the benefit of the money going to the place where he dictated. So that already would be a ribbis problem. But in these cases, it's not coming from the command of the malveh. So the Torah Tumima says that's his interpretation of what it means, that the only prohibition is if I ribbis that comes from a loveh to a malveh. That really means that I need really both of these elements of neshech and tarbis, and that the loveh has to have the neshech to lose something, and the malveh has to have the tarbis, that the malveh is getting something. But it doesn't at all mean that if the loveh is losing something and the malveh is getting something, but the money with the ribbis just happens to be conveyed to a third party, to a shliach, that would be permissible. That's not at all what the Torah is talking about. So he says, based on this interpretation, this is a perfect rebuttal against the shita that's quoted, that somehow you wouldn't have a problem of ribbis if it went through a shliach. Now, for ribbis to be a problem on a d'oraisa level, it requires ketzitza. It requires that this was how the transaction was initially set up. Meaning that when Reuven made the $10 loan to Shimon, he stipulated, when you pay me back, you have to pay me back $11. It has to be stipulated that there will be ribbis that will be paid at a later point in time. If it wasn't stipulated, and just later on, Shimon on his own says, I'm going to give you an extra dollar as interest, but it wasn't a ketzitza, it wasn't stipulated at the time, so that's only a bak ribbis. That's only considered to be ribbis on a rabbinical level. What's the difference as to whether it's a bak ribbis or whether it's ribbis de oraisa? So whenever it's ribbis de oraisa, so then it has to then we say it's yotze b'dayonim. Then if I have a din Torah for sure, maybe even without a din Torah, but certainly if I have a din Torah, so then the money would have to be the extra money would have to be returned by the malveh to the loveh. And if it's only ribbis to a button, it's only a back ribbis, so then if the loveh forked over the money to the malveh, then the malveh doesn't have to be bedine adam. Doesn't have to give the money back. B'dinei Shemayim, he has to give the money back, but B'dinei Adam, he doesn't have to give the money back. And then there are even lower levels of ribbis, where somebody just gives a gift after the fact or before the fact, where it wouldn't even have the status of a ribbis de rabbanan and would be considered to be even more lenient. So there are different shades of ribbis, but the ribbis, the araisa, in order to be ribbis, which is prohibited from the Torah, has to have a ketzitza, has to be stipulated up front that the ribbis, that the money can only be paid back with interest, and then it actually gets paid back with interest. So that has to be returned by the malvin. Now, do we say that the entire transaction is null and void? So Shulchan Aruch says no. The entire transaction is not null and void. If the transaction spelled out, let's say it was a shtar, and the shtar spelled out that $10 have been loaned, that's the keren, and there's $1 being charged for interest. So the shtar gets challenged in court in Beis Din. That after all, this is an interest-bearing shtar, and it shouldn't be enforceable. We say we don't enforce the interest, but we do enforce the principal. We do enforce the keren. We just don't enforce the ribbis. The keren, as long as it's distinguishable from the interest, the keren still gets paid. This is different from secular law. In secular law, believe it or not, is a common misconception that interest is just always permitted across the board in secular law. So it's not entirely true. In secular law, you can charge interest, but only up until a point. Usually, there are usury statutes that say that after a certain point of interest, this is taking too much advantage of somebody. This is already loan shark territory, and we're not going to enforce the contract anymore. So in New York, the prohibited rate of interest is 16%. I believe. And if it's already 25%, then the person could get into criminal trouble for it. But in terms of a 16% interest, so what does that mean? So according to the secular usury statute, if that amount would get charged, then the entire loan would be considered to be null and void, and the lender wouldn't be able to collect anything. So I once had a lawyer who said to me that he would always recommend, beyond the halachic requirement that a person bring a dispute to Beis Din as opposed to civil court, but he said that he would always recommend if he had two parties who entered into an interest-bearing transaction that was 16% or more, that they would do better at their collection in Beis Din than they would in secular court, because Beis Din would only knock out the ribbis portion but would still entitle the person to collect the principal, while if they were in secular court, they wouldn't be able to collect the principal or the ribbis. So generally speaking, if it's less than 16%, you go to Beis Din, then you can't collect the interest, you can only collect the principal, and if you go to secular court, you can collect everything, although you'll be violating halacha, obviously. But once it reaches the amount of the usuries, the civil usury statute under secular law, a person actually ends up doing better in Beis Din because at least they can collect the principal, while in a secular court they wouldn't even be able to collect the principal because the whole thing would be wiped out. So this, it's further interesting because in reality, this basically a simplified presentation of the difference between secular court and Beis Din doesn't break down necessarily as smoothly as I've just laid it out. Why is that? Because even in Beis Din, if case would be where there was a usury of, say, more than 16%, it's not obvious that according to the Beis Din Psak, the person would still be allowed to collect the principal. According to Halacha, they can collect the principal, but it may be that Dina de Machus Adina would be applicable over here, because there's a principle that we have of Dina de Machus Adina, that sometimes when it comes to monetary laws, you have to follow, you can't even bargain around the secular statutes. So when do we say that's applicable? So the Ramah at the end of Siman Shin Samach Tes and Kol Shem Mishpat says that whenever there is a compelling regulatory interest on the part of the government that this law should be enforced across the board, and they really care about enforcement and compliance with this law, so then it might fall within the rubric of Dina D'Machus Adina, and then it might be incorporated within Halacha. So there are certain types of laws where the secular law says one thing, but they don't care. You can follow Jewish law too. But then there are certain types of monetary laws where they say, no, you got to follow our regulatory scheme, like bankruptcy law. You can't contract around bankruptcy. You can't say, I have a Jewish creditor. So even though there is an automatic stay on all of the debtor's assets, they'll pay their Jewish creditors. They just won't pay the in Beis Din. But as far as the other creditors, they're going to they're going to either be discharged or everyone else will only get 10 cents on the dollar. There's an interest that the bankruptcy law would be applied uniformly with respect to all the creditors. Everybody's in this business together. It's important for the economic well-being and stability of the entire society. And therefore, everybody has to comply with the priority scheme of collection rights of Moshe Feinstein when it comes to conformity with bankruptcy laws. The same may be true with respect to usury laws, that there's such a compelling state interest that people not take undue advantage of each other, that if they charge more than a certain amount, 16% or more, that it's so important that even the principal not be collected. So it could be that even from Dina D'Bachus and Dina grounds, the person wouldn't necessarily do better in Bezdin. That's a possibility. And on, as far as the other end of the equation, with respect to what happens in secular court, well, it's not entirely clear that a person in secular court wouldn't be able to collect more than 16% if the loan transaction was made in a halakhically appropriate fashion. What does that mean, in a halakhically appropriate fashion? So I'm going to jump a little bit, because much of the contemporary discussion regarding ribbis really revolves around how do you, in fact, enter into these types of transactions in a permissible fashion. Is there a way in which I can extend $10 to you and have the expectation to receive $11 back, which is how much of a commerce operates and much of how the business investment world today works? I was a lawyer for a period of time, and practically every single transaction has a loan element. Why do people enter into business transactions? The idea is you're giving away a certain amount of money with an expectation you're going to get more back. That's the way basically most transactions work pretty much on every single end. So how do you assure to some degree a rate of return without violating the halakhic prohibition against ribbis? So there was a proposal made based on various gemaras. The gemara talks about an iska. The Gemara talks about the notion of entering into, this is the Gemara in Daf Kuf Dalet Amud Beis, and Baba Metzia talks about two individuals who enter into a partnership, a joint venture together, where there is a possibility of gain, but also there is a possibility of loss. So we have the investing partner, the one who's contributing the capital, the one who's contributing the money, and you have the managing partner, the one who's going to be investing the money. And we say the way in which people feel the most comfortable investing their money in this type of an iska is, says the Gemara, that it's, if it's palga milvil, palga pikadon, over rabbanim milsa, denichale the lobe, venichale the malve, that we have some sort of an arrangement that works out well for the borrower and works out well for the lender. What is going on? What's this iska idea? The idea is that I give you $10, and we say five of those $10 is a loan, but five of those dollars is a pikadon. That's something which I'm not necessarily ever going to get back. That's something which I'm leaving you to invest, and if things don't work out, you're never going to have to return it to me. You invest this entire amount. You invest the palga milva, palga pikadon in some venture, the $10 in some venture. So if you make money off of it, so we share in the profits, because the half of the lova, the half of the amount, which is the lova, the loan amount, that's my amount. That you just have to give back to me, okay? Whatever profits, excuse me, that's my amount to get back, but your amount to invest. You had the right to invest the hova amount because I gave you money. Milva lehotzah nit. No, you could use it for whatever you want to use it for. Okay, I'm only guaranteed the principal back because otherwise it would be ribbis. So that's all I'm allowed to get back. No more, no less, I get back. But whatever you make off of the money, that's completely yours. Okay, so you keep that amount of the profit. On the other hand, with respect to the pikadon portion, that amount you're investing on my behalf. So whatever profit is made from the pikadon portion goes to me. So in terms of the overall profit, you get to keep the half that comes from the milva part, and I get to keep the half that comes from the pikadon part. And if there is any type of loss, so I lose the half that comes from the pikadon part, and you lose the half that comes from the lova, the hava part. Because the halva part, those $5, you have to return to me no matter what. So therefore, from my perspective, as the one who's giving the money, I have a certain comfort level that I know that I am going to get my $5 of my hovo back. I'm going to get no matter what. Now, I may lose the $5 of my pikadon, but on the other hand, if there's a profit in the overall venture, so I'm going to get 50% of the profit. And from your perspective, the person who is receiving the funds, you will basically only be obligated to give me half of the investment. So if the investment goes bad, so you know that at least you're not going to be responsible for half of the funds that you received. The pikadon part, if it went bad, you're never going to have to return to me. And you also have the benefit of knowing that you're going to get 50% of the profits. Now, because of the fact that part of what I'm giving you is a hovah, part of what I'm giving you is a loan. So therefore, if I make you work on my behalf, that might be considered to be ribbis, because ribbis does not necessarily only consist of receiving extra money. Ribbis can also be extra services, called the bar sheyishach, says the Torah. It could be anything that you do on my behalf. So therefore, the fact that you're investing the money on my behalf, that could also be ribbis. So for that, I have to pay you a schar tircha. I pay you a certain sum of money. It could be a token amount of money. So that's something that also is part of the transaction. I have to give you a skar tircha. The skar tircha could also be interpreted, could also be applied in terms of percentages. It could be that we'll agree that instead of my getting 50% of the profits, I would only get one third of any profits, and you would get one half of any, I would only get one third of any profits. And we could also, or maybe we'll share in the profits, but I will suffer more of the loss. If there's a loss, so then I will have to incur two-thirds of the loss, and you will only have to incur one-third of the loss. So we could also break it up in terms of percentages, but I'm going to have to give the managing partner, the one receiving the funds, just a little bit extra, either in terms of a flat payment or in terms of a percentage of benefit for the fact that they are investing the funds. And that's basically how an ISCA works. Somebody have a question? That's basically how an ISCA works. So later day Poskim said, why don't we take this model of ISCA and adapt it for purposes of enabling investments where the provider of the money can be even more assured of their return? According to the ISCA, if things go bad, they're going to lose 50% of their investment. But maybe, just maybe, we can work it out in such a way that they're going to be a little bit less likely to lose 50% of their investment. Yes?
You mentioned that you stipulate that if it goes bad, you'll lose more of the percentage than you will. And that works as hard, even though if you gain, you still are making more money.
If you gain, you'll share. But you both get 50% if it gains, but in the event that it loses, so then that's what the Gemara says, that you can make such a stipulation. So there were poskim who came along a few hundred years ago, and they came up with this idea of a heter iska, that we're going, some call it a shtar iska, because it's really a shtar, it's a document, but because it creates a heter, it creates a leniency, so we sometimes refer to it as heter iska, because it makes matters better. What's the idea behind the heter iska? You enter into this iska arrangement. However, I would say to the person who's investing the funds, so we would share equally in the losses. But who says I should believe you that there have been any losses? You're going to come to me. You say, I'm sorry, we lost the whole thing. It all went bad. So here's, you know, your $5 loan back and the $5 pikadon you're never going to see. And it might not be $10 altogether. It might be $1 million. So I'm going to lose $500,000. I don't want to lose $500,000. So I say to you, what do you mean there was a loss? Prove to me that there was a loss. I'll only believe you that there was a loss if you can produce two witnesses. So if you don't produce two witnesses, so then you don't get to discount the portion of the funds that was considered to be a pikadon. Furthermore, says the Truma Sedeshin, I can say to you, I'll only believe you if these are the two, I'll only believe two specific witnesses. They have to be the rabbi and the chazan of the shul who never ever leave the shul, and they have no idea what's going on in the marketplace. They have no idea what investments are losing money. They never even heard of Madoff. They don't know anything. I can say to you that it has to be a specific two witnesses. And furthermore, with respect to the prophet, so fine. So you can't have witnesses who are going to testify that there wasn't profit, because how do you see profit? You can see a loss, you can see someone invested money, you can see it went bad. How could you see that there wasn't a profit? So for the profit, you'll have to take an oath. And we'll make it a very strict oath that you'll have to take a Shavua Chamura B'Nakitas Chayfetz in front of the entire congregation. You're going to have to take a very serious oath in front of everybody. And we know that most people are reluctant to take oaths, Bisman Hazeh, especially an oath with a Sefer Torah, Uah. So I will only believe you as with respect to losses if you produce certain witnesses who you're probably not going to be able to produce. You could theoretically produce them, it's just unlikely. And I'll only believe you with respect to that there wasn't a profit or that the profit was less than a certain amount if you are willing to take a Shvua Chamura, you're willing to take an oath on a Sefer Torah, which you're also unlikely to do. But I say to you, you know what? I'll let you off easy. Instead of you having to bring these witnesses and you're having to take an oath, you can do that. I'm not taking away your ability to do that. You have to be able to do that. There has to, otherwise it's a pure ribbis bearing transaction if there's not even a possibility of my not getting the interest. So you can do that. But in the event that you pay me a certain anticipated sum of profits, that's a reasonable anticipated sum of profits. Let's say that we anticipate that the profit for the venture will be 10%, so therefore, since I'm entitled to half, you'll give me 5% of the overall investment, so then you will be off the hook. Then it's okay. You don't have to bring the witnesses. You don't have to take the oath. You'll give me this amount. All is forgiven. We will assume that this was the amount of profits that you yielded. As long as you give me that amount, that's going to be okay. So then this becomes a return on the investment rather than an interest payment. It becomes not a ribbis payment, it becomes a return on the investment. If you're able to conjure up the witnesses and you're willing to take the oath and all that, that the investment really went sour, you're not going to have to pay me back. However, if it makes life easier, which it probably will, then instead you just pay what we anticipate was probably a reasonable return on the investment to me, and I get 50% of that for my chatzi pikadon. So then everything is copacetic, everything is hunky-dory, and I'm able to receive the sum, and it's not considered to be ribbis. So that is, in a nutshell, how the Heter Iska works. It works essentially as a joint venture transaction. Now, this could get you, if you enter into this Heter Iska, and we have a form here, if you want to look at just a very simple formulation, I reproduced the Bezdin of America form of Heter Iska, of how people can enter into these types of transactions with each other. Page 11, it's on, all right? Basically, you turn the loan into a business transaction, really a business joint venture. This says that the one receiving the money attests either the undersigned that received from the person providing the money, the sum of, say, $100, repayable over 2 years, for the purpose of transacting business in connection with, and then you can write what the business proposition is, in connection with a purchase of shares in IBM, in connection with a purchase of shares in Google, all right? Now, what's the problem if I do that? The problem is, then I might, as the as the provider of the funds, be able to look up and see how IBM did, see how Google did. Maybe they, over the 2 years, they're going to lose a lot of money, right? Maybe not, but maybe, you never know how a particular company is going to do, right? Sometimes companies go up, sometimes they go down. So if I know for a fact that the fortunes of the investment went down, so then already the whole thing becomes a little bit more farcical. I say, I don't believe you that there were losses. Well, I don't have to believe you that there were losses. I just can look in the newspaper. I can look in the business section, and I can see that there were losses. So therefore, later they postgim recommended that instead of saying the specific investment, they say in connection with all investments in which you are involved, meaning that all investments that you undertake, that it's very open-ended. I don't know what investments you're going to undertake. Maybe you'll undertake investments that will make a lot of money, and maybe I don't even know about where you invested the funds, and there's a possibility that you invested it in some profit-making venture. The truth is that maybe it would be good for the form to be amended in order to specifically give some broad language like that, unless, of course, the parties want to increase their risk of in order to make it more more straightforward that, in fact, if it goes bad, so they're agreeing that they'll take that risk. However, if the purpose, which is to minimize the risk, which is in fact the purpose of the shtar iska, so then it's good to broadly define the investments in which profits and losses are to be equally shared, right? Because we're assuming a chatzi milver of a chatzi pikadon form. However, the said provider of the funds has agreed that in lieu of such sharing of profits and losses, which would require substantiation of all losses by two trustworthy witnesses, as we mentioned, and verification of all profits by oath, he shall accept, meaning he doesn't have to, meaning that we're still allowing for the possibility that witnesses can be brought and an oath can be brought, but in the event that the receiver of the funds decides to make this payment, so then the provider shall accept it. He shall accept my payment of an annual percentage of, let's say, 10% of the said sum of $100, and waive, meaning it will be $10 a year, because we're assuming, let's say, 20% profit, so that he would get 10% of the overall profit, and waive all other profits which may be earned from the advanced funds. And then we have to add, of course, I have received a token payment of $1 from the said provider of funds for my efforts in connection with this undertaking. That's what we described before as the payment for his efforts, the schar tircha, and have signed herewith the receipt of the said $1. By the way, what happens if the $1 doesn't get paid? So if the $1 doesn't get paid, so that's pretty much, then you have a real ribbis problem, because then the person who received the funds is expending all of his efforts and energies on making the investments without having received any compensation. That's ribbis for the loan that he received. So it's very important for the $1 to be paid. There has been a suggestion made that maybe the person receiving the funds can say hiskabalti, that's ki'ilu hiskabalti, that it's, I am deeming it as if I received the money and therefore you don't have to give it to me. So I believe that Rabbi Bleich approached of Yaakov Kamenetsky about this proposal. Can you say that it's hiskabalti, that it's as if I received the money? And Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky didn't like it. He felt that was going too far. That once you're doing it already, you have to actually give the money. So if you look in all the Ribbis Svarim, everybody says, without even bringing a source, nobody says like why it shouldn't work to say it's as if I received the money. Everybody says this money really genuinely has to get paid. If there is a fear, as we mentioned, that the money might not get paid, because we have lots of transactions, people enter into these iskas. How many of them say, here's $10 for the iska, and here's an extra dollar for your efforts? How many really do that? They're all supposed to do that, but how many really do it? So in the event that there's a fear that maybe it won't be done, so then you could presumably go back, and some of the heter iska forms have this formulation, go back to the Gemara's formulation and just say that we're not necessarily going to make it a 50-50 proposition. We'll say that if there's profit, so then I'll get one-third and you'll get two-thirds. Or if there's losses, I'll suffer two-thirds and you'll suffer one-third. Again, I won't believe you that there are losses, that there weren't profits, unless you bring the witnesses and you take the oath, and we'll stipulate that whatever, that if you pay a set amount, you'll be off the hook from having to prove that. But it could conceivably be set up in that fashion as well. I saw another couple of hands go up. Yes.
In general, do we use the shtar iska for all loans, or only loans that are really for the purpose of a business transaction? Meaning, are we trying to circumvent all the...
So this was a big diyun. There was some poskim who felt that really it should only be used in connection with real business transaction, where there's really going to be a business venture. The Shaul Umeshiv made popular the notion. I didn't put it in the sources, but Shaul Umeshiv, Madura Kama Chela Gimel Simen Kuf Samach. So the Shaul Umeshiv made famous the notion that even if it's not for a business proposition, the fact that you're providing somebody with funds so that they can keep on to their other assets, or that they can continue to pursue whatever enterprise they were other pursuing because of the fact that you're making this money available, even if it's just to pay their mortgage, or even if it's just to buy necessities for their home, which isn't, you know, per se a profit-bearing investment. Since you are freeing up their other assets and enabling those assets to be invested, even freeing them up to continue their profession, which will yield assets in the future. They can go to school and they'll be able to make money in the future. So that also could be included within a shtar iska. That would be the justification, for example, for using a shtar iska for a student loan. Make a student loan, the student's not getting anything. You could say, even if he's getting something, say he has to pay it for tuition. Say, okay, so maybe he won't really pay it on tuition. He'll pay, you know, he'll invest in the stock market or put the money on a horse race or something. But we assume he's going to, you know, use it for tuition. But even beyond that, I'm not giving him the money. I'm giving him a credit. I'm saying that I'm giving you a loan as the school institution, as YU. I'm giving you a loan. You're not getting a penny, but this is money that's being applied towards your tuition, and you're going to have to pay it back. So that can also be done through an ISCA, according to the Shaul Lameshi, because it's freeing up your other assets. You'll say, I don't have any other assets. What if other assets? It's freeing you up to be able to go to school and get an education, and therefore conclude this investment, which will enable you to land a really lucrative job. You know, Yeshiva College graduate, you'll be able to land a really lucrative job afterwards. So it's freeing you up to pursue that investment. So according to the Shaul Lameshi, that could also be done subject to a shtar ISCA. So once you have everything under a shtar ISCA, so this raises a separate secular law problem, which is that it's not really the intention of the parties to enter into a full-fledged joint venture. If I enter into a full-fledged joint venture from the perspective of secular law, so then the result could be that even though I've given you $100 for the investment, if I'm your joint partner, and now you incur $1 million worth of losses, I could be out not $10 or not $100 or $50, but I could be out $500,000 because I'm your partner and you lost $1 million. Somebody slipped and fell on the premises of the business. And since I'm one of the partners of the enterprise, so I also might have joint and several liability with you. So that wasn't the intention. So how do you avoid those pitfalls from the perspective of secular law? So most of the civil law cases which dealt with the idea of shtar ISCA, where it was brought to kind of make the point that this was really a joint venture and a joint enterprise. So most of the cases out there say that as long as the document made clear, I think the Beis Din of America form is good with this because it starts off with the words Jewish religious law, that the document was just being entered into for Jewish religious law purposes, then they're more inclined to understand that the terminology of how we're characterizing the transaction does not necessarily create a joint venture or partnership for secular law purposes, that it has a very specific meaning for halakhic purposes. It does mean that there is some sort of a joint venture arrangement, but it's limited in terms of the halakhic implications of that category as opposed to what the secular law implications of that category might be. How is this relevant to the scenario that I initially mentioned to you of the loan that has more than 16%? So there was such a case, actually. It was called Labor Vicky, was the name of the case. I think I quoted it in my materials. If you look in page 4, Labor Vicky versus Rawicki. How this would involve Jewish parties, I have no idea. But this is a case that involved Jewish parties, and where they entered into a transaction where more than the civil usury rate had to be paid. Whatever it was, 16%, whatever the rate was at that time, it exceeded the civil usury rate. And the claim was that they shouldn't be able to collect the rate. So the court in that case said, well, given that there was a shtar ISCA document, leaving aside the implications of whether it would be viewed as a joint venture for all secular law purposes, let's assume that wouldn't be the case. Nonetheless, said the court, when it comes to the public policy consideration behind voiding usury agreements, that is a public policy consideration that's very much dependent upon the intent of the parties. Did the parties have an intent to engage in a usurious transaction? And the fact that the parties sign a shtar ISCA, says the court, the fact that they sign a heter ISCA Jewish law document saying that this wouldn't really be considered to be interest showed that they didn't have the requisite intent in order for this to be usurious, and therefore, even though it's more than 16%, they will be able to collect it in civil court. So rather than the scenario that was described to me by the lawyer, that the person will be worse off if it's a 60% or more if they're going to be in civil court, the reality is that they could be better off than your standard borrower, provided that they entered into a shtariska agreement. If they entered into a shtariska agreement, the Leiber Vicki case says that it was clear from their intention when these agreements were entered into that it was intended to be cast as a payment of profits, and to pay a part of profits in lieu of interest with no guarantee of profits is not usury, and therefore the full amount could be collected in that particular case. Now, yes, does somebody have a question? Good. Now let's go on with respect to the possible applications of the heter iska. When is it going to be required? When is it going to be necessary? So we describe your standard transaction where one person is extending money to the other person with a desire to get more money back. Your standard ugger nutter type of case. So that requires interest to be paid. So we said that we can also have avak ribbis, you can have ribbis the rabbanon, rabbinic interest, and we said, what are scenarios of rabbinic interest? So I mentioned to you, if I have a sale-purchase transaction where the purchaser is paying more money because they've been given more time, basically, to buy the item. So that is a case of ribbis derabbanan. So ribbis derabbanan is still prohibited. But there is one, there are certain leniencies when it comes to ribbis derabbanan, beyond the one we mentioned earlier that it doesn't, that we don't force the collector, the malve, to, or the deemed malve, to return the ribbis, at least be de'odom. But the Gemara on Daf Ayin Amud Aleph says that there are certain types of monies that could be loaned out by ribbis derabbanan. What's the example that the Gemara gives? The Gemara gives the example of ribbis shel yesomim. If I have money that belongs to yesomim, to orphans, so then says Rav Sheshes muta mumol shel yesomim muta laavosan karv leskar rochak lehefsid. That such money can be loaned out in a fashion that would only be rabbinically prohibited. It's called karv leskar rochak lehefsid, where the principal is guaranteed, and they can also get a profit if there is a profit. If there is no profit, they won't get it. So that's rochak lehefsid. You can't lose, but there's a possibility that you might gain. So that's ribbis derabbanan. That's also rabbin, even though it may not come to ribbis, but you can't. But because of the fact that the malva is in a better position, they can't lose, they can only gain, so that's also prohibited as ribbis derabbanan. So we say that would be permitted if you're dealing with mal shel yesomim. So the Rishonim basically take off on this Gemara in two directions. They say, not only is this heter with respect to the scenario that I just mentioned of karv l'skar v'rochak mehefsed, but any kind of ribbis derabbanan would be permissible when it comes to mal shel yesomim. And not only is it mal shel yesomim, but any kind of money that's being used for a charitable organization, like a for Talmud Torah or mal shel tzedakah, whenever it's being used for charitable purposes, so then we're going to permit ribbis derabbanan, we're going to permit what otherwise would be rabbinically prohibited interest. So this opens up various kulos, for example, with respect to a yeshiva. So if you have a yeshiva that wants to engage in ribbis derabbanan, so then according to this Gemara, that might be permissible. What are other forms of ribbis derabbanan? Well, there is a big machlokus about whether it's permissible to collect extra money if it's not in the form of agor nutter, but rather it's in the form of a knas. What do I mean by that? Agor nutter means that I am establishing up front, you're going to have 2 months to pay this back, and because I'm giving you 2 months, I'm giving you nutter, a waiting period, I'm going to get ugger. You're going to give me some extra money. But what if I say, you pay me back in 2 months, you don't have to, you pay me exactly what I loaned you. I'm not loaning this with interest, but you know what? If you don't pay me in 2 months like you're supposed to, then I'm going to give you a penalty. I'm going to give you a knas. So then you have to pay me back an extra amount. I'm not saying that that extra amount is based on a longer amount of time. If you pay me in 2 months and a day, you got to pay me that extra amount. If you pay me in 2 months and 20 years later, you got to pay me that extra amount. The extra amount remains exactly the same. It doesn't buy you extra time. It becomes due immediately when you don't pay on time. So that's called the knas. So many poskim say, and there are gemaras that seem to support at the end of Baba Basra or elsewhere, that's not considered to be agor nutter. That's not considered to be prohibited. That's just a knas. So there are some who say that's completely permissible. However, the general consensus is, like the Rashba writes, the Rashba says, even though it should be permissible, it's haramis ribbis. It's a way of kind of getting around the ribbis prohibition and say, it's not really ribbis, it's a penalty payment. So because of the fact that it allows one to kind of cheat around prohibition against ribbis, we don't permit it. But even though we don't permit it for a loan transaction, we would permit it for a commerce transaction, for a purchase transaction, where something's not paid on time, you can have a one-time knas, or let's say I have a landlord-tenant relationship, where the tenant is supposed to pay their lease on the first of the month, and we say in the lease, if you don't pay on the first of the month, so then we're going to impose a one-time penalty upon you. It's going to be a $10 penalty fee that's going to be imposed upon you if you don't pay the first of the month. This isn't a loan transaction. I'm not loaning the tenant. The landlord's not loaning money to the tenant. It's a it's simply a business arrangement or a housing arrangement where rent is supposed to be paid, and we have a penalty payment. So because it's not a loan transaction, it's a one-time payment, so that would be permissible. That would be considered to be... that would be considered to be something that's only prohibited in the context of a loan transaction. But this type of haramis ribis we're going to permit altogether if it's not a loan transaction. Now that's only the case if we're talking about a one-time penalty fee. If I'm going to say that this penalty fee will itself accrue extra charges the longer you don't pay, then basically what I'm saying is that I am paying, that you are going to have to pay me for every single delay in payment an extra amount of time. That becomes ugar nutter. That's called knas hamizrabe. If I have a penalty payment where I say, if you didn't pay me on the first of the month, it's $10, and guess what? If you didn't pay me by the 10th of the month, it becomes $20. You didn't pay me by the 30th of the month, it becomes $30. You didn't pay me until the end of the following month, it becomes $60. If it becomes knas miserabe, it keeps on getting larger and larger, the longer and longer that you don't pay. So that's already ugar nutter, and that already would be prohibited even if it's not a loan transaction, even if it's a landlord tenant transaction. So I have sample lease clauses right here on page 2. If you look at paragraph 10, it says, if any payment is overdue for a period in excess of 10 days, the late charge is 5 cents for every dollar so overdue for each month or fraction of each month from such payment's due date until payment is received by the building owner. So does that seem to be a one-time penalty fee, or is that what we would call a knas hamizrabe? Knas hamizrabe, it says so in the notes. So that would be a problematic lease clause. However, if you have a lease clause that simply says, if any payment is overdue for a period of X, these are real lease clauses, that's why they're so arcane. If any payment is overdue for a period in excess of 10 days, the late charge is 5 cents for every dollar so overdue. For each such overdue payment, that's perfectly fine. And by the way, you could do it for any overdue payment as long as it's a one-time fee. So if you pay the February rent late, and there could be a one-time penalty fee for that. And if you pay the March rent late, so there could be a one-time penalty for that. Because with respect to every single payment, it's just one penalty fee that's being imposed. But if that one penalty fee can become larger as time goes on, so then that becomes problematic. Yes?
What if it's like a security where in a renting sort of a case, the renter like gives a certain amount of security, be it, let's say, that if they don't pay on time, the landlord gets to keep a certain amount of that security, and if it continues, they get to keep more. But the landlord takes all the money to begin with.
So they talk about that, and they say that it really depends whether the landlord is getting the security. Is the security just sort of put away in the bank for the tenant, and the landlord doesn't really keep the security at all, and then at the end of the lease term, the security is just applied towards the last month's rent, so that might be perfectly okay. If the landlord is actually deriving interest payments on the security, so that's problematic. So anyway, let's say you have then an institution. Let's say you have a yeshiva, like, for example, say Yeshiva University. And Yeshiva University wants to make loans that it will receive interest for, okay, for students to have student loans. So can this be justified? Is this ribbis d'araisa or ribbis d'rabbanan? So there is an argument to say that any loan which doesn't involve cash, where basically all payments are only going to be made by checks, the checks are not gufo mamon. And the Gemara in, there's a Tosfos that suggests that maybe a ribis with karka, with real estate, is not considered to be ribis. There's losa simun alav neshech. It has to be something which is something which is it has to be ribis kesef, ribis okel. It has to be something which is either kesef or shav kesef. It has to be something which is either money or okel is a commodity that has the value of kesef. But if it's not gufa mamon, like karka, Satosa suggests that maybe that's only midrabanan. And then the Ran in Ksuvo says, well, maybe that Tosos didn't only mean karka, but meant shtaros also. That even if I have notes of indebtedness, a shtar, so that also there's no ribis with respect to a note of indebtedness. So this is not codified at all in Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch assumes that the ribis would apply to everything. Doesn't even rule out the karka. But the Bris Yehuda says in a footnote that if you're going to be makel about like the Shita of Tosfos, there are some who say that it has to be gufa mamon to be daraisa. So then checks also are only ribis midrabanan. So that's a big question. And that most the poskim do not agree, as far as I can tell, with that chiddush of the Bris Yehuda. Some say it only depends on how the checks function. And it could be he was only talking about the way checks function in Eretz Yisrael, but elsewhere, really, it would have a separate thing, and it would be closer to Gufa Mamon. So it's very questionable whether that heter could be relied upon in terms of justifying student loans to be paid back beribis. But it has been advanced. So Schechter is famous for quoting this particular heter, saying that all the ribis, it's only paid in checks, it's only drabbanan to begin with, it's a mitzvah yeshiva institution, therefore ribis drabbanan is permitted, and that's why we can justify the notion of student loans. But is there another approach as well, potentially? So there are other possible approaches. One approach is to say that a student loan is not really a loan. A student loan is the student has to pay tuition, and I'm saying that that's a service. It's not a loan, it's a service. And I'm saying that you're not going to pay tuition today. You're going to pay it over time. So therefore, I'm going to charge you a larger premium. So you're paying over time. So that's already commerce. That's ribis drabbanan. So therefore, I can be makel on that basis to say that it's only, that maybe ribis drabbanan should be permissible. Is there any basis to be makel based on the fact that I'm not dealing with a person? We said that one of the big principles of ribis is that the Torah only prohibited ribis abba milove lamalve. So maybe I don't have a love, maybe that requires a real flesh and blood individuals as opposed to an institution, right? The yeshiva is not a person, right? The yeshiva is an institution. So therefore, maybe there's room to be makel. So here I put in your sources the famous tshuva of the Igros Moshe that you should all know about. Yoredei Achelik Bei Simon Samach Gimel, where Moshe Feinstein writes that if I'm dealing with a corporate entity that has limited liability. What does limited liability mean? It means where you can only, let's say you have a claim against the corporation, you can only go against the corporate assets, but you can't go against any of the people. You can't go against any of the shareholders, owners of the corporation, only against the assets. Once you exhaust the assets, you can't go after the people anymore. That's called limited liability. That's how corporations work. Corporations, you can't go after the person, you can only go after the assets. You only have shibun nechosim, only a shibun on the assets and no shibun aguf. So Moshe says a real loan, what does a loan mean? A loan means that there's shibud aguf. It means I have a love who has shibud aguf, who has a real obligation personally to have to pay money. But if the love, if the borrower is a corporation, I invest money in a bank. So I'm not going to be able to, even though I'm investing it with interest, I'm not going to be able to go after any of the offices of the bank for the interest. I can only go after the bank's assets. So therefore, that's considered to be only Shibud Nechasim, and it's not Shibud Aguf. Says Moshe Feinstein, that's not a problem at all. That's not a ribis-bearing transaction. There's no real love over here. I only have somebody with Shibud Nechasim whose assets are on the line. There's no person with their who's on the line. It's only the corporate assets. I can't go after any particular individual. Since I can't go after any particular individual, therefore that's not considered to be ribis. So the Minchas Yitzchak disagrees with Rav Moshe, but the Minchas Yitzchak says, it's still considered to be ribis, but even according to that shita, it's probably only ribis drabanan. It's probably only rabbinically prohibited interest. And it happens that many poskim say, certainly when push comes to shove, there's room to be makel, there's room to rely upon Rav Moshe Feinstein if I'm dealing with a corporate entity from which you are collecting interest. However, that only works if the corporate entity, if the institution is the borrower, right? So Yeshiva University is borrowing money, so that could be a justification for Yeshiva to borrow money and then pay it with interest, because there's no person. What person are you going to go after? You're not going to go after any particular person. As much as any one individual might seem like they personify Yeshiva University, in fact, there is no personification. It's just an institution, okay? You can't go after anybody's particular assets. You can only go after the yeshiva itself. So therefore, according to Rav Moshe, the yeshiva would be able to, without any problem at all, borrow with interest if it's a ribbis, whether it's a ribbis d'oraisa or a ribbis d'rabbanan. Certainly if it's a ribbis d'rabbanan, pretty much everybody should agree that they would be able to be the borrower. But according to Rav Moshe, even if it's a ribbis d'oraisa, they would be able to be the borrower. But what if you're talking about a situation where I have an individual borrower, I have a loveh who's an individual borrower, but the malveh happens to be a corporation? So if it's a corporation where you kind of know who the shareholders are, then at least you can argue that I have a real individual, I have a malveh that I can identify. For purposes of the malveh, it doesn't matter whether the shivat nechasim or shivat aguf, because the malveh I'm not collecting from. But what if it's an entity like a yeshiva where there's no particular bialim per se? It's not like I have shareholders. There are no bialim yiduim. So the Rashba is a famous chiddush. The Rashba was quoted in source 14 by the Beis Yosef in Yoredeya Simen Kuf Samech. So the Rashba says, "Sha'alta ma'asamcho akshav la'avos mos tamat Torah b'ribis liYisrael." What do they rely upon? The money from Talmud Torahs are loaned out beribis for a collection of interest. So Tshuva Efsha Yelodin Lahatir says he thinks there's room to be Mako Kiman Deina Ribis Barmi Lova the Malve, because the money's not really going to a real life Malve. She'ein Lamamon Zeh Bailam Yiduim, because the Talmud Torah doesn't have any owners. El Shein Roy Lasos came, but the Rashba adds that it's not appropriate to rely upon this Pen Yifritzu Gedder Bezeh B'Mokom Acha. Maybe people will rely upon this when it's inappropriate. Aval Yesh Ma'am Kazel Lahatir Kedei Lefanei Saktanim Yatamidim Shem Komam. However, it is appropriate to try to find leniency in order to take care of the Talmidim. So he comes up with one kula that he says, it's not really ribbis, just the people are giving extra money because they want to take care of all the Talmidim we have to learn. That's not considered to be ribbis. So we understand they're paying the money not for ribbis, they're paying it because everybody has to make sure that the Talmidim are well fed and well kept care of. And then he has a separate tshuva, tshuva acheres kasu marshal hektei shaniim mistaba shemutal avos and karvus karvochok lehafsid. He thinks that at least ribbis drabbanan should be permissible kemosha yisam when you're dealing with charity funds. Recovering loma shen ribbis avla hektei shaniim lebi shemos edo elim bialim yiduim. And he thinks that maybe there shouldn't be ribbis altogether, even on a deraisa level, because there are no clear owners. Begizwa lo b'shal atzma hu malve, the one who's the treasurer is not using his own money. V'nimsa shem yibesem ba'ami lo v'la malve, v'chad shein lo mos lo v'shal sova ba'ilam inesem. Since there are no ba'ilam, there's no malve, why should it be prohibited? Mikol makom. And this is the part of the Rashba that's generally relied upon, as opposed to the previous Rashba that seemed to indicate that we'll just call it not ribbis, we'll call it your support of the Talmidim in the yeshiva. Here he's more direct, where he says you should only rely upon this for ribbis drabbanan. Mikol makom l'maisini omalavos ribbis ketutza. I wouldn't say to rely upon ribbis d'oraisa. It's called ribbis ketutza. About karlis charakol efse nearly shemutah kamal sheyisomim. But if it's ribbis drabbanan, so then he's prepared to be makel. So then one could also say that when you're dealing with an institution where the malve is a yeshiva. So according to the Rashba, you have a separate kula as well that essentially at least all ribbis d'rabbanan should be permissible whenever I have any institution where there are no bialim yiduim. So even if you wanted to argue, it's not a Talmud Torah institution. According to the first heter of the Rashba, you can collect if it's for Talmud Torah purposes. Let's say an institution has many graduate schools, and some of the graduate schools are just professional schools. They're not. Someone's getting a loan not to learn Torah, they're getting a loan to learn a profession. So that's not necessarily included in Mal Shel Talmud Torah. But if the institution itself, nonetheless, doesn't have Bailam Yiduim, it's not owned by anybody, so then you could still be Mako, you could still rely upon the Rashba's Heter that there are no Bailam Yiduim, at least the Rabbanon interest would be permissible under those circumstances. So in order to, you know, address the concern that maybe just to be extra safe, we should enter into a shtar iska, so it happens that we have drawn up at least a sample shtar iska to be reviewed by Yeshiva University. The Yadin Kolel worked on Learn Hilchos Ribbis last year. We drew up a shtar iska form, and the shtar iska form basically says that even if the money isn't going directly to the student, the money is freeing up other assets of the student that can be invested in whatever purposes, and therefore the whole scheme of the iska can be applicable in order to justify use of the iska under those circumstances. However, as we see, there are other heterim here based on, number one, the mode of payment, number two, the fact that it may not be a loan but simply the payment for services which is put off, and number three, you certainly have heterim to potentially rely on at least the extension of Ribbis Durabanan if you're dealing with a charitable institution, or according to one formulation of the Rashba, even if it's not a charitable institution but it's an institution that doesn't have Bailim Yiduim, so that could justify loaning money at least for Ribbis Durabanan. Did somebody else have a question? Or I saw a hand up. Okay. Now, in terms of just some of the things that you might not even think about, in terms of the daily types of interactions that people have, there is a principle that ribbis is a prohibition between two Jews. But if you're dealing, let's say, with a bank, which is a non-Jewish institution, according to their laws of usury, you're okay as long as you're under 16%, so you can go along. You can go along with that. Where people sometimes make the mistake, they don't realize that even if a loan originates through a source like a non-Jewish bank, which wouldn't present the problem of borrowing money, say, from a non-Jewish bank, but then if that same loan is then extended by the Jewish borrower to another Jewish party, so that does, according to the Shulchan Aruch, that does constitute ribbis. That's viewed as two separate transactions. So somebody asks me to, you know, take money from my bank, and then they will, so that because somehow their credit isn't good. So they know that I would be able to secure the loan, and then I'm going to give the loan to them, and they'll pay it back. So that is prohibited. That's considered to be interest because it's considered like I have two separate transactions that are going on over here. There's a transaction from the bank to me, and then there's a transaction from me to you. And my transaction from me to you is an interest-bearing transaction. Even if I tell you, pay the bank, the halacha is that if I say to you, here's $10, as we said at the beginning, if you're paying the money at my dictation, so then you're paying the money to me because you're giving it to a source I wanted to go to. I give you the money, and I say, don't give me the money, give the bank the money. Give, you know, the following Jewish party or non-Jewish party the money, it doesn't matter, that's going to be considered to be ribbis. And it's the same thing if, for example, I let you use my credit card because you don't have access to your own credit card, so I let you use my credit card, so then it's considered like I borrowed money from my credit card, you borrow money from me. If there are interest payments that need to be made on that money, so that's basically interest that you're paying me. Either you're paying me directly or at my direction, essentially, you're paying the credit card company because of the fact that I extended this to you. So these are all considered to be problematic. These are yom-yom type of problems that exist all the time. You want to make this type of a loan in a shtar iska type of way, you could do it in a shtar iska type of way. But otherwise, it's problematic. As we said earlier as well, that Nesha called the Varash Yishach, Afilo Ribbis Dvarim, that even a person, you know, says something, does something other than paying money, but they're doing something favorable to me because I gave them money, that's also considered to be ribbis. So if I give you ribbis, I give you money, and then you volunteer to shine my shoes, so that's also considered to be ribbis. Not only that, but the Gemara at the end of Ezehu Neshech says that if you never used to say good morning to me, I didn't rank, but now I gave you money, so I rank. So now you pass me in the hallway, you give me a big smile, you give me a big bracha, you give me a big shalom. So then that's considered to be ribbis, says the Gemara at the end of Ezo Neshek and Daf Ayin. That's considered to be ribbis as well. There's a whole dion in Shlomo Zalman Orbach and in the Mincha Shlomo, where he talks about, are you allowed to say thank you? Somebody gives you a loan. So is it considered to be ribbis if you say to them thank you afterwards? So this is not a davar pashut at all. So he says let me see if I can find the tshuva. What page is it on? I'm sorry.
Page 4
in the materials. So he says that there are achronim who wrote that a lova should not say to a malve toda, shouldn't say thank you. Rabbim nogim mishum kaklamar makom said tiskol mitzvos, and instead people will say tiskol mitzvos. So he thinks that that's completely wrong, because he says that tiskol mitzvos is like a bracha, like the person saying shalom. So you shouldn't say tiskol the mitzvos. That would be much more problematic. However, if the person is simply saying toda, so he didn't think that toda is necessarily a payment of ribbis. It's simply that the lova is demonstrating that he's not a kafui tova l'shum adam, that he's not somebody who lacks a demonstration of appreciation for what people do, and it's appropriate for a person not to be a kafui tova. So that's his svara as to why he thinks tiskul mitzvos is a problem, but saying thank you he thinks is okay. Now, what's interesting is that Rav Moshe Feinstein is sort of confronted with a similar type question in the Igros Moshe, was asked, are you allowed to say thank you to somebody who loaned you money and made it possible for you to publish a sefer, because they loan you money towards the publication of a sefer? So Rav Moshe kind of seems to go in a little bit of an opposite direction. He says that he thinks a lashon of toda is prohibited. Therefore, one should not write in the sefer. They shouldn't write thank you in the sefer, but they could write as a lashon hoda'a, as just sort of a factual matter in the sefer, that this person, because of the fact that they gave money, is barach min hashemayim, because he's just saying the truth. Somebody did a chesed. They gave money towards the publication of a sefer. Since they gave money towards the publication of a sefer, so of course they're going to be yisparach min hashemayim. You're just publicizing the fact that this is somebody who's obviously, through their actions, they're going to be worthy of a blessing. But he said very strongly that it would be ribbis dvarim if you did say thank you. So this is questionable. It almost seems like they're saying sort of opposite. So Shlomo Zalman Orbach says you can't say tiskul the mitzvos, you can say thank you. Rav Moshe says you can't write the thank you in your sefer, but you could say yisparach min hashemayim, that the person's going to be blessed. You have to draw like a very thin distinction between saying tiskul the mitzvos, you wouldn't necessarily be zocha the mitzvos if not for the fact that I said so, and yisparach min hashemayim, where I'm just stating a fact that of course you're going to be yisparach min hashemayim. It's a little bit of a thin. A little bit of a thin distinction. It could be that maybe the best thing is that somebody who gives a loan, you can simply write the following people extended loans. That's factual. It's not in the realm of making a bracha altogether. I'm just suggesting. I'm not poskening. Not in the realm of suggesting a bracha. You don't get into any of these shots. You're just saying, in fact, the person made a loan. So it's like you're putting in the pinkas. The person made a loan. If they ever take you to Bez, then they'll be able to open up the sefer, and it's like a shtar, that memorial law. That's right, a shtar, that a person made you a loan. So it's like you write a shtar in the sefer that the person made a loan. Maybe that's the best pshara. I've heard a svara, I believe, from Rabbi Willig a number of years ago, that it could be the thank you is not problematic for a separate reason, because the thank you is not in America, at least, where people say thank you as a verbal tick. You know, it's not it doesn't have a meaning that you're being machzik tovah to them, or you're giving them any kind of bracha, or you're giving them anything. So that's the way people talk. It's like you say hello, you say thank you. Somebody says, can you drop something off at my house? They call you up at night, you know, you're a little groggy. You say, yeah, sure, I'll come, I'll do it tomorrow, whatever. And you say goodbye, thank you. Why are you saying thank you? You just agreed to do something for them. You say thank you, because that's the way people talk. You don't think that's like goodbye. You say thank you, goodbye. You say it doesn't have any meaning. It's just the sort of thing that flows. You have to say something. If you don't say anything, so it seems rude. So, you know, you just the people in there kind of, they converse with each other. So that's a word that we come up with, even if it has no relevance to anything that has to be thanked. So you just say the word thank you. So that's a possible justification for saying thank you. So I don't know. The best thanks is just you pay back the load on time. That's probably better than saying thank you. Probably if you pay back the load on time, you don't say thank you. The person is just to say they'd be happier that you pay back the money than you say thank you. So therefore, you're not going to be in worse shape because of the fact if you want to be machmir and not say thank you, I don't think that it's going to put you in bad shape per se. Sometimes there are awkward things that you don't say, even though it feels very natural to say it. The Rav held that after a Kohen, Duchens, Kohen's is Nisr, the Kohen's not supposed to be Mosif on the Bachos, it's a violation of Los Osif. So he held that after a Kohen Duchens, he shouldn't say Baruch Tiyah. Somebody goes over to the Kohen and he says Yashikoyak, so he's not supposed to say Baruch Tiyah. Rabbi Schwartz is nodding, he's also a Kohen. So that's very, very difficult. So I, but because it feels rude, you're just coming off from the duchening, and everyone's saying yashikar, yashikar, and you're going, and you can't say, and they're expecting the baruch to yeh, but you're not giving them the baruch to yeh. So not because they're expecting another baruch, it's just like that's considered to be the polite, normal thing to do. So I was just in Eretz Yisrael, and I got an aliyah on Shabbos at Gruss, and then later on, I duchened as well. So then afterwards, Rav Shapta came over to me and he said, "You're Shikarik." So I said, "Oh, yeah, Baruch Tiyah and the Aliyah." Yeah. So because I once asked Rav Shapta this question, I said, it's very awkward. Do we really have to be makvid about this this issue of not saying Baruch Tiyah? So he indicated, yeah, I don't know. He indicated that he thought that it was appropriate. So sometimes the halacha requires us to be a little bit awkward. Okay, so I don't know that it's the end of the world. It's not entirely clear about the Toda, but we see just how incredibly detailed and how incredibly personal the laws of Ribbis can become, even in the types of transactions that we would consider to be very normal and very commonplace. Another, type of situation to be cognizant of is the notion of sa'a bisa'ah. So there's a din d'rabbanan that when I give you money, so I get back money, even if there's inflation. And the inflation is such that maybe the value has... if there's inflation, the value has gone down, I'm getting back less than what I gave you. So even if there's inflation, you can't pay me more money, because we say money, even if you think that it's changing its value, it doesn't really change its value. Money doesn't really change value. So I gave you $100, giving me back $100, money doesn't really change its value. So that's with respect to money. It works both ways. Even if now $100 is worth, can buy more today than it was able to buy 2 months ago when I made you the loan, you're still giving me back $100. So the money is fine. But what if I'm giving you commodities? What if I'm giving you apples? So there's a halacha that I can't give you 20 apples today for you to pay me back 20 apples 2 months from now. Why is that? Because there's a possibility that maybe apples are considered not to be tibba, they're payra, they're considered to be commodities. There's a possibility that the apples will go up in value. And really if they go up in value, then I'm getting ribbis, because I'm not getting back 20 apples, I'm getting back something which is worth more than the amount that I originally gave you. So we can say that I'm giving, making a loan worth the value of what 20 apples are worth today, and you'll give me back that value later on. But I can't, stipulate that you're going to give me back 20 apples when there's the possibility that the 20 apples will go up in price. There are a couple of exceptions to the rule. One exception to the rule is if you have the type of commodity that I'm giving you already have. So then it's not. Then we could say you don't have to go out to the marketplace and get more of it. Or if there's a marketplace, there's a market value for it that's already been established. But generally speaking, if you don't have the heterim to rely upon, then there's a problem of sa'a b'sa'a. This applies with foreign currency as well. If I'm in America and I loan you shkolim, so shkolim are considered to be a commodity because the value of shkolim will fluctuate every single day. It could be at the time time you're going to pay me back the shkolim, maybe they're worth more than when I gave you the shkolim. They're not considered to be legal tender in America. They're only legal tender in Israel. So therefore, that's problematic. That's problematic as well. So that's also something to be cognizant about. And discounts can be a problem as well. If it discounts and late, let's say that I get a discount for prepayment of an item. I want to buy something from the store, and the store says that if the usual price is $10, but if you prepay, so then you only have to pay $8. So that's ribbis. How's it ribbis? I'm giving less money. So how's it ribbis? It's ribbis because of the fact that you are giving more of your commodity because of the fact that I am giving you a prepayment. So because of the fact that I'm giving a prepayment, so this person is giving more of their commodity as a result of the prepayment. So you can't. So that that would be considered to be problematic. That here I'm getting more of a benefit because of the fact that I gave you extra use of the money. So here, like a newspaper prescription subscription. Let's say that that you have a newspaper that you're printing. Let's say it's a Jewish newspaper, right? So if I give you a let's say you say the market price on the stands is that it's $300 for or let's say it's $30 for a year's subscription, but if you pay 2 months in advance, so then it's only $25, and I give it to you, but I'm not getting anything right away, so I'm waiting for the merchandise. So you're giving me a higher value. I only gave $25. Normally I would only get a certain amount. I would get less newspapers. You're giving me more newspapers because of the fact because of the fact that I'm willing to wait a little bit until you give me the payment. You're paying me in newspapers, but it doesn't matter. You're paying me in something, and because of the fact that I was willing to pay a little earlier, so you're going to give me more than I otherwise would have been able to purchase with these $25. So that's problematic. Again, there too, you can rely on the heter that if the borrower, in this case, the newspaper is the borrower, they're borrowing my prepayment, is a corporation, so maybe there's room to be makel on that basis. But if you don't, some wanted to say that if it's a Torah, I saw this quoted in a footnote in the Torah's Ribbis. Torah's Ribbis said that if it's a Torah journal, so then since this is only Ribbis to Rabbanan, it's not an outright loan, it's in the course of commerce, so it's a Torah journal, so you're supporting Torah activity, so therefore Ribbis to Rabbanan could be permissible. I was sort of surprised to see that svar, but some brought that svar as well in the context of a Torah newspaper. Yes, you had a question?
Yeah, what about sales buying in bulk? Like if you know, say we buy one, so it's this price, but if you buy, you know, 10 of them together, so then it'll be a different price.
Right, so a lot depends on whether the product is readily available. Meaning that if a person has a product which is readily available, then there's more room to be made because you can set a price. If something doesn't have a set price, for example, so if it doesn't have a set price, so then you can make up whatever price you want, as long as you don't say that there's some sort of a two-tiered system that you get one price for paying early, and then it's another price if you're paying later. Because the whole problem of ribbis is agunotar, is the fact that there is more of a price that you're paying because of the fact that you're paying late, or there's more of a benefit that you're receiving because of the fact that you paid early. So if you have an agunotar set up, so then you have a problematic situation. If it's not agunotar, so then there's more room to be lenient. I quoted, I gave you materials in the Torah's ribbis having to do with hatsmada. Hatsmada is just an important word. When it comes to inyani ribbis bizman hazeh, so you should know the word hatsmada. What does hatsmada mean? Right, we have a hatsmada program, so this is the hatsmada program. So then in the ribbis hatsmada program, basically you have a linking. A linking that you can sometimes do if you're worried that one type of denomination that you're loaning in is a very insecure denomination and you want to link it to a different denomination, so that's something that could potentially be permissible. What's a possible manifestation of that? If you look on page 22 of the materials, Shin Pei Gimel, so let's say you're in Eretz Yisrael and the person is engaging in a transaction of shkolim, okay? So a person can do like this. Actually, turn back page 19 is probably a better case. Let's say somebody wants to give shkolim, and in case there's going to be a downgrade in the value of the shkolim, they don't want to have to lose out from the. They don't want to have to lose out. So they can do like this. They can say, "I'm going to pay you. I'm going to give you shkolim, but you're going to pay me dollars. What's the dollar rate going to be based upon? It's going to be based upon what the dollar rate was at the time that the halvah took place. So at the time the halvah took place, let's say that it was three shkolim for a dollar, and I'm loaning you 30 shkolim, so you're going to pay me back $10, okay? Because essentially, this is considered to be a... this is considered to be a psika. It's considered to be almost as if I'm buying dollars with the shkolim. It also helps that in Eretz Yisrael there are many poskim who say the dollars are also considered to be legal tender in Eretz Yisrael. There are poskim who hold that way as well, so that also helps. But I can basically give you these 30 shkolim, but what we make up that you're going to pay in $10, and because we make it as kind of like a sale transaction of shkolim for dollars, so let's say that at the time now that that you want to pay up, instead of paying up in the $10, you're going to pay up in terms of you're going to pay up in terms of shkolim, okay? Meaning that even though the piron is supposed to be with dollars, so now let's say that at the time of the payment, you want to pay up in dollars. So let's take a look over here. One second. Look at Mem Dalet on page 21. In Misyaiku Adolarim, let's say that at the time of payment, now it comes time to pay the $10. Based on Piron, Motzli for Bishkolim, Makom Dolarim, Kefi Erkam Ismana Piron, Yesh Matir Miyesh Olsim. So there are those who say that it would be permissible to pay in dollars, and there are those who say that it would not be permissible to pay in dollars. So that's a question. And the question becomes, do we say Mali Hain Mali demand that once it's acceptable to pay up in dollars, so why not at that point convert it to shkolim, even though it will end up that you're actually paying more shkolim, because after all you're allowed to pay the dollars, and you know you have the dollars, right? So that's basically a machlokis among the different poskim as to whether that is permissible or not. But he says the mikra zeshel dollar in the footnotes, they should sarf hadeyas asorim shadino kemapeh. If you're in Eretz Yisrael, then there's more room to be lenient because you can argue that the dollar itself was essentially legal tender, and you're just converting the legal tender. One second. Even according to those who are stringent, the fact is that when we're dealing with this type of a commerce transaction, if the goods that were supposed to be transmitted are available, but they just agree that they're going to turn it into other money, and let's say the shkolim is the real money, then they can do that. So if that's the case, if the lova has dollars, but both of them say, even though you're prepared to pay in dollars, we're just for the sake of ease, because we're living in Israel and it's easier to buy things with shkolim, then we're going to transmit, we're going to convert it to shkolim, mutter, so then he thinks that that would be permissible. So that you would basically end up with a transaction where the parties, where there's a transfer of shkolim to begin with. Let's say that the shkolim, where I had 30 shkolim for $10 and I loaned 30 shkolim, now $10 are worth 40 shkolim. We say, I'm prepared to pay you the $10, but just to make it easier, let's make it 40 shkolim. So it actually, if it's done in this fashion of Hatzmada, it actually could be permissible under those circumstances. So Hatzmada is just a very important device, very important technique to be aware of in terms of being able to deal with inflationary rates when you have multiple currencies, and the ability to have this back and forth, and this way the ability to protect yourself against these types of fluctuations in rate, there is a possible way of going about doing it according to this description of the Torah's ribbis. And the various applications of Hatzmada are important halakha l'maisa. One has to be very, very careful with them, but just you should be aware of this concept, because in terms of modern day discussions of ribbis, this is very important. The Minchas Yitzchak has a tshuva that I included in the materials, the common case where somebody, you know, pays up, they have a loan, and they're paying up the loan, but it turns out they don't have exact change. It could be that somebody purchased something for you, and now you're paying them back, but you don't have exact change. You owe them 97 cents, you give them a dollar, and say keep the change. So he says he doesn't think that's a ribbis problem, because you're not giving it to him because it's ribbis. You're giving it to him because you want to save yourself from the tircha of having to find exact change. And therefore, it's just easier to give a few extra pennies. But to be on the safe side, he recommends saying that the extra amount should be given to tzedakah. And he also deals with the case of, what if you don't remember? Yeah, somebody went and they bought things for you, they bought a meal for you, and now you're trying to figure out exactly how much you owe them. You calculate the tax. The whole thing is, you know, very difficult to figure out. So you say, yeah, I don't want to pay you too little, so I'll give you this amount, which for sure will cover. It's probably a little bit extra. So are you allowed to do that? So he quotes an Amnei Nezer who says that whenever you have sort of you're paying an amount, not b'toras ribbis, but because you want to make sure that you fulfill your obligation, you want to make sure that you're paying the right amount, the right sum, and you're not reneging on your obligation, so that's not really considered to be ribbis. So the SSA is there too, the Minchas Yitzchak is prepared to be mekel, but he says that you should stipulate that if you gave a little bit extra, even though normally we say that you can't, we don't rely upon, except maybe Tamei Dechacham, we don't rely upon saying you're going to give a little extra as a matana. It sounds a little bit too much like ribbis, but in this case, since there's room to be mekel, you're just giving it in order to make sure you fulfill your obligation, not to give him extra per se. So therefore, you could say that to whatever degree I'm giving extra, so that's going to count as a matan. It's kind of difficult to say give it to Stucco, because we don't know how much to give to Stucco. We don't know neither one is able to figure out what the amount was. And finally, since we have to just break up, there's so much to discuss. Vinyane Ribis, just to give you a sense of the extent to which these things become relevant in our own dealings. There's a tremendous literature, a tremendous discussion just a couple of years back about the proliferation of Jewish mortgage banks that would extend the mortgage loans and then sell them almost immediately afterwards to regular non-Jewish banks, immediately after the loans were originated, but for a few months they would live with the Jewish mortgage banks, and interest would be paid during that period, so they have a shtar iska for that period of time, for a couple of months, but then the loan gets sold to a non-Jewish company, and the first Simon, the famous Simon Kuf Samaches that I just told you about, indicates that when something like that happens, where it's going, the loan basically originates from a Jew to a Jew, and then the Jew transfers the payment to a non-Jew if the term of the loan included the term in which it's now going to go to a non-Jew. So the Chabad Das paskins that that's a problem of ribbis. And therefore, there's a whole big problem. Since the non-Jewish bank is not going to take the loan subject to a heter iska, how are you going to be able to justify this arrangement? So just to make a long story short, the proposal that was made by these Talmidei Chachamim, some of them Mechabrim and Sfarim on Ribbis, the proposal was that the transaction should be structured in such a way, and they have a form for it, the special shtar iska form, where the loan will be concluded, not to just transferred or sold to the non-Jewish bank, but it has to mamash be paid off and concluded. That has to be lashon, paid off and concluded at the time that it moves on to the non-Jewish bank, and then that has to be characterized not as the purchase of a loan, but as a completely new loan. And if it's done under those circumstances, even if various penalty provisions kick in and it gets kicked back to the Jewish interim mortgage banker, so then you have a provision, the shtar iska, that says that only under those conditions the shtar iska will continue. The last thing that I had in the materials was if there's somebody doesn't pay, let's say, a Bezdin debt, and then there's a collection action in civil court, and they charge fees for not collecting the debt. So there is an article here by Rav Mordechai Rabag about ribis pigurim, about to what extent there is an intersection between the notion of dina de machusa dina when it comes to court fees that get imposed for not paying a debt on time that was imposed by a bez din. We don't have enough time to go into that, so I'll just leave that for your further review. Bottom line is that many transactions where you might not necessarily even think that there's a ribis problem, ribis occurs all the time, be very, very careful when you extend loans to make sure that you assess your interactions with the borrower, that if you borrow money, that you assess your interactions with the lender, not to do things or say things, you know, more than you would have beforehand. And there are a lot of rules and parameters. So in general, one has to just be very mindful of these rules, very careful. And whenever there is a need to borrow money or to lend money, as much as possible if there is an anticipated return and desire for a return, to enter into a shtar iska and to make sure that everything is kedasu kedin. Thank you very much.